Thank you very much, Mr. Moore, and greetings to all of you and to those who are attending with us today. I also want to comment on, I felt that compliment to us, I don't know how deserved it is, but I certainly was moved deeply by it because we work very hard and we don't know if we're touching any people or not, or if we're really helping them. And to hear that we are, I mean, if it was just one, if it was just that wonderful lady, it would be worth it. And it just helps make the work worth it. So I want to thank her personally today. Now, let's go over to Job 10. One thing I think that we should notice as we read through Ezra during our reading period, that all through that time, you never see them negotiating with the people who were against them. They never cut a deal. They never backed down a minute. They stood fast. And negotiation is a dialogue between two or more people or two or more parties, and its intent is to resolve a point or usually to gain some advantage. And it is to come to an agreement upon a course of action to take generally, and it can be to bargain by an individual, by a group, and it is to try to satisfy the two different sides and or sides. And each time this happens, each party is trying to gain some sort of advantage for themselves by doing so. And in the end, negotiation almost always includes some sort of compromise. And it occurs in business. It occurs in nonprofit organizations like churches. It's in our government is rife with compromising, and it's used to settle legal disputes among nations and people. And it's so important that it fills our society today. The art of negotiation, they've even written booklets about this or books about how to negotiate. And there are negotiators that are professionals now who are buyout negotiators. There's peace negotiators. There's terrorist negotiators. There's negotiators who are paid for that purpose to be the negotiating leaders. And we live in a nation that has become a nation in which negotiations are almost a way of life for us. We use negotiations when we go to buy a car. We use negotiations when we go to buy a home. We use it in our marriage to make compromises so that things will stay together. And we use it even in child care and child rearing today. We negotiate with our children in the modern age today. But sometimes negotiating can backfire. For instance, this one little story I read that, of course, is not true, but it's kind of cute, I think. There was a New York family that went out and they bought a ranch out west, and they were going to raise cattle on this ranch. And so they began to talk about, well, what should we name the ranch? And they couldn't all agree on this. And so what happened was one of the men said, I wanted to call it Bar J Ranch. And his wife wanted to call it the Susie Q Ranch. And the son liked the Flying W, and the other one wanted the Lazy Y. So what happened was they couldn't ever come to a resolution. So they compromised, and they named it all of those, the Bar J, Susie Q, Flying W, and Lazy Y. And one of the people asked him, he said, well, where are all your cattle? And he said, none of them survived the branding. Thank you for laughing. That was very kind. So sometimes we can compromise and in our negotiations to our own hurt. But today there is what I think an enormous emphasis on negotiating. And it's just no accident, you know, because we can no longer order people what to do, it seems. Any organization of any kind has to have negotiating as a key skill in their repertoire. I remember a personal story regarding my mother, by the way, that that happened to me. I remember I was convinced that she was called into the church. She had listened to the program. I remember for her birthday present when I was a little boy, I bought her a little tiny radio. She could sneak into work so she could hear Mr. Armstrong on the radio. And she ordered the literature, and she would read it, and she would tell me about it. But my mother had been, at this time, been smoking for most of her life. And she had a pretty severe case of emphysema. She was tied to an oxygen line and an oxygen bottle all the time. She wanted to get baptized, but she was afraid. And so, you know, we tried to encourage her in different ways, but she was just afraid to go under the water because of her breathing problems. She was scared to death that she might drown or something. But during that period of time, something I thought was miraculous happened, and that was there were two times that she had a severe attack and had to be hospitalized. And she was in intensive care, and I watched her skin turn blue. I saw that. And then the doctor came out to me, and he said, "I don't think there's a chance she's going to probably die, so prepare yourself for that." And we called the minister, and the minister anointed her. And both of those times, these were the words the minister or the doctor said. He said, "Somehow she made a miraculous recovery, and her color's back, and she's like she was before." Both times. And you'd think with both of those cases happening, with miracles happening, that it would change somebody, it would increase their faith. But still she lived in fear, and she wouldn't get baptized. I asked her about it. You know, we encouraged her, but she just couldn't bring herself to even think about going under the water under her condition. And so she eventually died. There was no third chance for her. And but my point is that she negotiated with God. Think about this. If God would heal me, she'd say, if he would fix my lungs, I would do it. And so she was playing this card of, I'll do this if God does that. And you understand my point, that this happens in people's lives to a certain degree. All of us sometimes do this kind of thing. So anyway, have you seen it, you know, the way people will do it? If you get me out of this mess, God, I'll serve you. You know, if you'll take this trial away from me, I'll be faithful, you know. I actually heard one man say this. I'm telling the truth. If you let me win the lottery, I'll split it with you. That's right. That's right. They're negotiating with God. But you understand that this is the same thing the Catholic Church did when they sold their indulgences. If you give us so much money, then God will take away some of your time in purgatory. It's the same thing, negotiating somehow with God. I'll give you this if you give me that kind of thing. You know, and the reason I say this is because you and I are living in what I think are extremely perilous times. You know, we're still fairly prosperous in the world, and we're still used to having the modern conveniences that we have. But if you can see this, which I hope you can, we are living in a society that is terribly sinful, and where everyone's compromising. We are very much like Lot, living in a city that was evil, and it has its impact on us as a result, you know. And we kind of like it because we live and we profit in this city of wickedness. And so, you know, we make a pretty good living in the world. So we tolerate their wickedness, but we keep it at arm's length to a certain degree so that, you know, we don't get too polluted, you know. But again, there's varying degrees that we will let it come in and keep it away from ourselves. And so anyway, many of us have sometimes made compromises in order to keep our comfortable position that we have in lives today. And I want you to think about this, about our government today. We are negotiating everything, and we're doing it from a position of weakness. And this is hurting us, you know. For example, you know, used to be that gays were in the closet. They weren't really able to come out because so many people were against it. And the government realized that these guys, as their movement grew more and more, they represented a pretty big voting block. And so we see things like in Canada, if you preach, even just preach the words that are in the Bible about homosexuality, you are considered committing a hate crime. And now in America, we've got places that have allowed same-sex marriages to take place. And so you understand what's happening is they are negotiating to get more votes. They're negotiating to let what they know is not really a good thing. They don't agree with it. They aren't gay themselves. But they're negotiating in this to get a voting block to ensure that they stay in power. That's the whole thing behind this. And so it was a negotiation of the left to get their vote. You know, there is a famous negotiation that took place that I want to read about today in the Bible. And it was this: Job wanted to negotiate with God. He was suffering so much, and he wanted God to end it all. God had allowed Job to lose everything. So let's go here to Job 10, and Job is saying to him, "Why are you doing this to me? I didn't do anything wrong. What's going on here?" And he complains that it seems like the wicked are blessed sometimes. And so right here in verse 1, Job says, "My soul is weary of my life. I will leave my complaint upon myself. I'll speak in the bitterness of my soul. I'll say unto God, do not condemn me. Show me wherefore. Why do you contend with me? Show it to me." And then he says, "It's good unto you that you should oppress and that you should despise the work of thine hands and shine upon the counsel of the wicked." In other words, that God, in his mind, had kind of just not even looked at the things that he had done that were good. And yet he's looking at the evil people. God seems to shine his blessing on them. They seem to be getting along just fine. And he's complaining to God, you know, "Why are you doing this?" So let's go to chapter 13. So here he is arguing his point with God, you know. "What have I done to deserve this? I don't deserve it. Take it away. It's not right." He's going, "What have I done?" You know, he says this: "You don't take the time to break a leaf, and yet you're taking the time to make yourself my enemy." Listen to his words in verse 23 of chapter 13. Verse 23 of chapter 13. "How many are mine iniquities and sins? Make me to know my transgression and my sin." Come on, tell me. Tell me what it is. "What did I do to offend you? Wherefore, why do you hide your face and hold me as though you're your enemy? Will you break a leaf driven to and fro? And will you pursue the dry stubble? For you write bitter things against me, and you make me to possess the iniquities of my youth. You put my feet also in the stocks and look narrowly unto my paths. You sent a print upon the heels of my feet." And I know it sounds a little awkward, but what he's talking about is when someone was a criminal, they would put them in the stocks bare their feet, and they would take rods and hit their feet until they left an imprint. And that's what he's talking about here. So Job wants to negotiate with God. Let's go to chapter 16 and verse 21. He wants to represent himself in the heavenly court. In pro per is what they call it. And I think it's funny in that one sense. Oh, that one might plead for a man with God as a man pleads for his neighbor. And so he wanted to be represented and have somebody plead for his case against God. And then Job 21, he wonders why the wicked don't have the troubles that he have. And he argues that here he had striven to live God's way, and yet now he's suffering. And it was just wrong, just plain wrong, he's telling God. So he wants God, he wants him to answer him. He wants to argue with God. In verse 7, he says this, "Wherefore do the wicked live, become old, yes, and they're mighty in power. Their seed is established in their sight with them, and their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, neither is the rod of God upon them. Their bull genders and fails not, their cow calves and casts not her calf. They send forth their little ones like a flock, and their children dance. They take the timbrel and the harp, and they rejoice at the sound of the organ. They spend their days in wealth, and in a moment they end up going down to the grave." And so, like everybody else, they die. But look at the life they live in some cases, the cheaters, the liars, you know. In our world today, you see it. You know, a congressman walks into government, and he's a middle, wage earner type level. But he comes out a millionaire. And how does this happen? Well, they lobby, and they buy votes. And so he can sell his vote to whoever needs it at the time for money. And that's what our government does. And they seem to get away with it, and they live fine lives. And I remember there was this one guy, Sharpton. You know, he had 12 counts against him of tax fraud, 12 counts of tax fraud. And I read what they did. They said they censured him. And I thought, well, that's got to be something serious. So I looked it up, and you know what it said? What a censure is? You have to go before your peers and they tell you you've done the wrong thing. That's it. Imagine, just try one count of tax fraud for you and see what happens. But you understand, their life seems fine. They get away with all this stuff because they are playing the game, you know, that's going on here. So anyway, that's what Job is looking at here. And in chapter 23, it continues on. I mean, it's an interesting story, and I'm picking pieces out of it for us today because here's a man that wants to argue with God because he thinks he isn't getting a fair deal. And so, hey, God, let's look at this thing in reality, and I've been doing good, and I deserve this. It's a negotiating process in its own way. So in 23, in verse 2, "Even today is my complaint bitter. My stroke is heavier than my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him." He wants to know where. I want to look for God. I want to find him, and I want to talk to him about this, "that I might come even to his seat. I would order my cause before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I'd know the words which he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Will he plead against me with his great power? No, but he would put strength in me." Imagine saying that. "You know, there the righteous might dispute with him. So should I be delivered forever from my judge." Now God's his judge and he's against him, you see. And he's saying, if I could go and negotiate with this guy, if I could tell him my side, we could get together, you know, cut a deal, and he'd leave me alone, you know. So can you imagine wanting to face God directly? That would be so frightening just to be in his presence. Just too much to me. Anyway, Job and 31. Job is a wonderful story to read sometime because I know there's times when all of us think, why doesn't God bless me? And I know there are people that come into the church and they think, well, if I do what God says, you know, I'll get this yellow brick road into the kingdom and my life is going to become easier, but not so. So in chapter 31, verse 35, he says, "Oh, that one would hear me. Behold, my desire is that the Almighty would answer me and that my adversary had written a book." So he wants God to write a book. And what is God going to say in that book? Here he says, "Surely I would take it upon my shoulder and bind it as a crown unto me." In other words, God would, if God wrote a book about me, he would crown me with glory. He would just say, "I am such a good guy," you know. Okay, well, he did write a book, actually. I know, it's a little funny sometimes. But, you know, so much for the God blesses the good people concept, you know. Bad things do happen to good people, and there's a case for that and a reason for that that we'll talk about a little bit later. So guess what? He wants a hearing with God, and he gets one, you know. In 38, verse 1, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Who is this that darkens counsel by words without having any knowledge? Gird up your loins now like a man, for I'm going to demand of you, and you answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Declare to me if you have any understanding. Who has laid the measures thereof, if you know, or who stretched the line upon it? Wherein are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone of?'" And many commentators will tell you the reason God's using these terms is because Job was a great builder, and some suggest that he built the pyramid, the Great Pyramid. "Where were you when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy?" Can you imagine God creating the universe in this massive explosion, we think, in which all of these galaxies are speeding out at millions of miles an hour from a central point. And where were you when I did this? You know, smart aleck, you know what he's saying. "Or who shut up the sea doors when it breaks forth as if it had issued out of the womb? When I make the cloud, the garment thereof, and the thick darkness, swaddling band for it, and broke it up in my decreed place and set the bars and doors. And he said, 'Hitherto shall you come, but no further. Here you shall your proud waves be stayed.'" And I ask you, you know how big the ocean is. He set it there, and he said, "The waves come this far and no further." He made everything by design and by plan. And, you know, when you think of a builder who thinks he's righteous and he's complaining to God, I mean, if you could just see this from God's standpoint, where were you? Can you even begin to figure out any of this? You know, where does light come from? You know, something like that. Just amazing, you know, rebuttal here. So, and I can't read everything that he says just for the sake of time, but it's so well worth reading. But let's go to chapter 40 and verse 1. "Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, 'Shall he that contends with the Almighty instruct him?'" Can you imagine that? You're going to contend with God. You're going to instruct God. You're going to tell him what he should do. "He that reproves God, let him answer it. And Job answered the Lord, and he said, 'Behold, I am vile.'" And here you are, you know, in his presence. I've felt some of that, and his purity scares me to death. "What shall I answer you? I'll lay my hand upon my mouth." Good idea. Good idea, Job. "Once have I spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further." Then answered the Lord unto Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Gird up your loins now like a man. I'm going to demand of you and declare you unto me. Will you also disannul my judgment? Will you condemn me that you may be righteous?" Wow. Job isn't too good of a lawyer here. Have you an arm like God, or can you thunder like with a voice like him? Go ahead now, deck yourself with majesty and excellency and array yourself with glory and beauty. It's impossible for him to do that. In 42, Job gets the point. He finally gets the point. 42, verse 1, then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do everything and that no thought can be withholden from thee. So he didn't realize at the time, I don't think, that God was hearing every word he was saying. So be careful. You understand? Be careful. No thoughts withheld from him. Who is he that hides counsel without knowledge? It's Job. Therefore have I uttered what I understood not, he says. I uttered things, I just didn't get it. Things too wonderful me, which I knew not. And you understand, we come here and we talk about God and we think we understand, but I bet from his perspective, he's saying, you don't get it. You really don't get it. You get a piece of it, just a piece of it. Here I beseech thee, and I'll speak. I will demand of you and declare then you unto me. Speak back to me. I've heard of you, he said, by the hearing of the ear. But now my eye sees you. Wherefore, as a result, I abhor myself and I repent in dust and ashes. So God didn't exactly negotiate with him, you know. Contending with God, I think we would all agree, is pretty foolish of us to consider. But let's go to Genesis 18, because there's cases where I think people believe that some of God's servants have negotiated with God before in the past. I want to remind us that he knows our personalities, he knows our thoughts, he knows our weaknesses and our strength. And we can't demand anything of God. He is doing things with us that we are totally unaware of, and there's no way for us to understand what he's doing. We've got to trust him and believe in him and what he's doing. We may think it's terrible. You know, we may think a trial that comes on us is really terrible, but I'm telling you what I believe to be the God's truth, and that is this. In the kingdom, we will look back and we will say that that time of trouble that you and I went through, that's when we earned our golden character that enabled us to be in the kingdom. It's not the good times that get us there. It's not the rich times. It's not the fun, happy times. It's the times that we endure suffering that we learn to have the golden Christ-like character that God has. And so, look, let's not whine when we get into troublesome times. Let's understand that's the exact time that we are to be strengthened and obey God to our utmost. And silence and not complaining or arguing with him, but trusting him. You know, I'm not saying we can't pray and ask for God's help in these cases, but arguing with him or demanding or expecting him to do what we want is outrageous, you know. So there was a time when Abraham also thought that he could negotiate with God. Christ came to him and he visited him and he told his wife, make some food for him. And then he said, I'm going to just reminded him of the promise of having a son. And Sarah laughs and Christ says to her, you know, yeah, you did laugh, you know. And she's, no, I didn't laugh, you know. And it's just an interesting time. So anyway, they made some food and ate with him. And then Genesis 18, and Genesis 18 and verse 17. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do? Imagine being the friend of God. Abraham was a friend of God, so much so that when God says, I'm going to do something that's going to affect Abraham, I'm going to let him know about it. Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a mighty and great nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I know him that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord and do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham all that he had spoken of him. And, we want to be like that. You know, I know this person or that person. I know they're going to teach their children. I know that they're going to live the right way, and they're going to propagate that down through the generations. So he was certain that he would remain faithful, that Abraham would, and he wanted him to know what he was going to do. And so in chapter 18 and verse 20, "And the Lord said, because the city of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I'll go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come unto me. And if not, I will know. And the men turned their faces from there, and they went toward Sodom. But Abraham stood yet before the Lord." And so I ask you to consider for a moment that Christ did not go into Sodom and Gomorrah. The angels went in. Christ did not. He stayed back and talked with Abraham. Just imagine for a minute if Christ went into Sodom and Gomorrah and the people tried to attack him sexually. That is so disgusting to even think about that he would never, ever go in such a place. That place would be a horrible place for him to go. So anyway, my point is that he did not go in, and there's a place that says, you know, his eyes are pure, that he can't behold evil, but he did behold evil, but he wasn't going to go into be a part of it. So anyway, Abraham thinks he can negotiate with his creator now in chapter 18, verse 23. "And Abraham drew near, and he said, will you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Peradventure, there be 50 righteous within the city. Would you also destroy and not spare the place for the 50 righteous that are in? That be far from you to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked." Here we are again, telling God what he should do and what his values and standards should be. "And that the righteous should go as the wicked, that be far from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? And the Lord said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I'll spare all the place for their sakes." And so Abraham thinks, I won this round of negotiation with God. I got my way. I talked to God. I talked God into this. You see where I'm coming from here. And so and Abraham answered in verse 27, and he said, "Behold, now I've taken upon me to speak to the Lord, which I am but dust and ashes." And then he's a little emboldened, though, by his success. He's talking very respectfully, but if you go down to verse 28, "Peradventure there shall lack 5 of the 50 righteous. Would you destroy the city for just a lack of 5 of them?" In other words, 45, you know, or 40 and 5. He says, "I won't destroy it. There's 45 people there. I won't destroy it." And then in verse 29, he spoke unto him again, and he said, "Peradventure there shall be 40 found." And he said, "I will not do it for 40's sake." So he's still thinking of his nephew Lot, is what he's doing here. You know, there's got to be a handful of people here. And he said unto him in verse 30, "Don't let the Lord be angry, and I'll just speak, you know, just one more time here. Peradventure there's 30 be found there, and I won't do it." He says, "If I find 30 people there, I'm not going to destroy the whole place." And he said, "Behold, now I have taken upon to speak unto the Lord. Peradventure there be 20 found there," he said, "I'll not destroy it for 20's sake." So he keeps lowering the number. Do you see the negotiation that's going on here? He's playing the negotiation game here. So anyway, and he said in verse 32, "Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I'll speak yet but this once. Peradventure 10 shall be found there." And he said, "I will not," that is Christ said, "I will not destroy it for 10's sake." And the Lord went his way as soon as he had left communion with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. Now, I'm convinced about this story here that these verses are misunderstood by not only Abraham, but I think they're misunderstood by many of us. The perfect, unchanging, great God in heaven does not negotiate with men, or anybody for that matter. He does not do it. He does not need a human being to tell him what is right or wrong. This is silly to even think that's possible. So Abraham may have thought all this time he's negotiating with God, but he drew the wrong conclusion entirely. He thought that God might destroy the righteous with the wicked. You see the difference here? God wouldn't do that. He doesn't have to be talked into it. He wouldn't do it, you know? So anyway, let's go to Genesis 19. God will not destroy one righteous person. He allows the wicked to exist. Now listen carefully, for the righteous to exist. He lets the wicked continue to exist so the righteous can live among them, is what it's about. And so it took Abraham several questions before he came to this conclusion. He got it, I think, at the end, and he asked then, and then stopped asking anymore. He realized he wasn't negotiating with God, and I think he had, as we should have, an eye-opening epiphany when it comes to this. We should understand the nature of God, you know. And Abraham realized something of enormous importance, that he is an everlasting God, a God of righteousness, and a God of love. And he will allow the wicked to live to preserve the righteous. In Genesis 19 and verse 27, Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord. And he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain and beheld, and lo, the smoke of the country went up as the smoke of a furnace. That was one hotbed. And it came to pass when God destroyed the cities of the plain that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot dwelt. And so he, because there weren't 10, there weren't 5, there weren't 4, there was one righteous man, righteous Lot, he's called in the book of Hebrews. Because of that, he took Lot out of the city and saved him and preserved him before he destroyed the city. And I say this as a reminder that God's people that strive to be righteous today are going to see wickedness get worse and worse. But God uses this as an example to us. Do you understand? He will save one. There'll be two in a bed, and one's taken and one's left. He will preserve the righteous before he destroys the cities. He will do that. That's his nature. That's his way. That's the example he left us. And when he talks about taking the people to a place of safety, he uses Lot as an example. And that's what the way he works, you know. So let's go to Exodus 32. There's one other time, and I'm just trying to clarify some things here about the way God works and about this issue of negotiation. So let's go to 32 of Exodus, because some people, I think, also consider this to be a case where you can argue with God. So all of that that happened to Lot was an example for us at the end of the age. But here's another case where somebody thought they could negotiate with God, and it was Moses. He recounted receiving the commandments, and he talked here to the people about this. Here he is. He's up in the mountain talking with God, and he hears this sound, and God says, go down there. And God was absolutely furious. How soon did it take for these people to turn to false gods? They're down there worshiping this false god and doing orgies like they probably saw going on in Egypt. And Moses explains in chapter 32 and starting in verse 7, "And the Lord said unto Moses, Go, get you down, for my people, which you've brought out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them, and they have made them a molten calf, and worshipped it, and have sacrificed thereon, and said, These be your gods, O Israel, which have brought you out of the land of Egypt." How insulting. "And the Lord said to Moses, I've seen this people, and behold, it's a stiff-necked people. Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may wax hot against them, and that I may consume them, and I'll make of you a great nation." That's kind of tempting. You'll be the great nation. They'll all come from your loins. "And Moses besought the Lord his God and said, Lord, why does your wrath wax hot against your people, which you have brought forth out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Wherefore should the Egyptians speak and say, For mischief did he bring them out to slay them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your first wrath, from your fierce wrath, and repent of this. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self, and you said unto them, I'll multiply your seed as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I've spoken of, I'll give to your seed, and they'll inherit it forever. And the Lord repented of the evil that he thought to do unto his people." Now, what's really interesting here is that Moses is calling them his people, that is God's people, and God is calling them his people. You see here? Now, some people would read this and they would think that, oh, God somehow forgot his promise to Abraham, you know, and so he had to be reminded, and that made him stop doing this. I don't believe any of that. This thing had gone on for a long time. You read the whole story and you'll see that Moses is saying, your people, Israel, your people, Israel, your people. And then God's saying, your people. But Moses didn't accept that until now. Now he invested himself. Do you see what God did? God knew what he was doing all along. He knew what was going to happen. And so he said, I'll just kill them all. Oh, no, don't do that. Don't do that, you know. So now Moses finally gets invested in the people. He finally cares about them and wants to save them. And now he sees them as his people. He's not just a nursemaid to these guys. He's one of them. They're his. And I believe that God was doing that for this reason. And that it wasn't a case of Moses was negotiating and saying, well, did you forget about your promise? And, you know, did you do that? You know, what about this? You know, oh, okay, yeah, you got a point there, you know. That was not happening. And so there wasn't a negotiation going on there. So, anyway, God was doing this. This was not a negotiation. He was playing Moses so that he, Moses, would come to be invested and care about these people. And so in that context, I want to talk just a little bit about what's happening with us here. We have watched in the last few years America negotiate passively. We have seen what happens. We lost the Panama Canal. We negotiated a peace in Vietnam. We never won that war with that little tiny country. We never won it. We negotiated a peace to get out of it. We allowed illegals to stream in, some of them terrorists, to stream into America. We have allowed drug cartels to infiltrate our nation. And now we're getting complaints from the farmers down by the border that they're being told, you have to pay us to drive on these roads, to drive your produce, to sell it. The cartels are demanding money from them, extorting money from them. And we're allowing it. We're not stopping it. We're not doing anything about it. We've allowed terrorists to blow a hole in a ship. There was no repercussions. Nothing happened. We allowed 9/11 to occur with no real retaliation. You know, we should have just destroyed them for that, you know, and told the whole world, this is what happens when you do this to us. But instead, we kind of just go along fighting in Afghanistan, and I feel our men are dying over there. And what are we getting? Sand. You know, sand, some sand. It's just terrible. But anyway, we ignore our promise to Crimea. You know that we had an agreement with them that if they would lay down their weapons, if they would get rid of their weapons, we promised them we would protect their borders. And we just passively let this happen. And we say, you shouldn't do that. No, bad. And now what do you think's going to happen? What do you think's on Putin's mind? He's going for the whole thing. He's going for the Ukraine. And then he's going to go for the Baltic states. And what do you think is going to come of that? Europe is going to get scared. This could have a significant role in developing some kind of unity and leadership in Europe to deal with this threat of Russia. That's always why we had NATO there. We had NATO there to protect them and keep those two sides of the world apart. That was the whole point, so that Russia couldn't invade Europe. And now NATO's gone. And now he's going, I see America's weakness, their passivity. You know, they'll negotiate in such a way that we can go and make an agreement with Iran, and yet we leave big holes or certain places we won't look at and investigate. They'll let us come in and investigate, but not over here. And we think we made progress, but they're just putting everything that they don't want us to see over here where we can't look. It's just weakness, and it's negotiating from a position of passivity. And we just don't want to disturb the way things are. We don't want to get out of our comfort zone. And it's going to spell disaster, the likes of which the world has never seen before. It's going to be horrible, you know. So my point, again, is I think Europe is going to develop its own protection to stop Russia's push. And you see that push coming, and you see us doing nothing. Well, we'll put sanctions on you. We'll put sanctions on you. Well, okay. You know, it's ridiculous what's going on there, really, you know. So I think it'll lead to a stronger and stronger Europe and eventually a beast power. So as I stated earlier, we are living in what I think are very perilous times. We have all these modern conveniences. We want to keep our way of life of abundance and leisure. And it's so easy for us to modify ourselves to fit at times. And it's easy for us, it seems, to change our loyalty. I want to tell another story that's not really true. I'm getting good at this. But it's so appropriate to me, you know. It's easy for us to change loyalties today. It's easy for us to say, I'll make a commitment and then not keep it. So anyway, there was a man that was on and he had been stranded for 15 years on an island out in the middle of the ocean. After 15 years, he's finally found. A ship came by, saw him. They sent some people to rescue him. When the people got there, they were amazed. This guy had been there for 15 years. He was a hard worker. He was industrious. He actually built some roads. He built himself a home. He built some other buildings. And the men came and they were so impressed. And they said, you know, this home is pretty nice, you know. And he said, yeah, it's nice. And they said, what's this building? He says, oh, that's my bank. I actually store things that I think are precious in that building. And they said, well, what's this? And he said, well, that's just sort of a warehouse where I store the things that, you know, I might need later, you know. And he said to him, well, what's this building? There's two other buildings over here. What's this? He says, oh, that one's my church that I attend. And then they said, well, what's the other one? He said, that's the church I used to attend. But I mean, you understand what I'm getting at, how we are all playing musical churches here today, you know, and I think it's really funny. But my point is, we live in Sodom and Gomorrah today, and we live in the shadow of enormous corruption, and Americans are taking a passive stance to the changes that are taking place. And I'm saying that we can't let these things affect us. No negotiating. I ask you today, I really want you to think now, is there anything you absolutely will not negotiate? Is there? Or will you fudge sometimes? You know why I ask that? I've fudged in my life. I know how the game works. And today I'm talking about negotiating. We don't want to negotiate with the world when it comes to God's law and his way of life. We don't want to give in, and we don't want to be passive, and we don't want to follow any of the trends that this world is following. We have to be different, you know? And I just want to go to Nehemiah for a second because I think it's so interesting that we've been reading through this book, and we're going to eventually get to Nehemiah, but, you know, over and over, as I stated in the very beginning, they never compromised. They never tried to negotiate with their enemies. They did what they were told to do, and they built this place, and they wouldn't stop. Nothing was going to stop them. Nehemiah 6 and verse 2, that Sanballat and Geshem sent unto him, saying a message, "Come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono." But they thought to do me mischief. In other words, they wanted to negotiate. Come meet with us and let's talk this thing over, you know. And they wanted to get some leverage on him to do mischief, to get him to bend some. And he said, "I sent messengers unto them, saying, I'm doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and come down to you?" And then they sent unto me the same message four times. And he said, "I answered them after the same manner each time." Now, do you understand that every day represents a time when something in the world is pulling on us and wanting us to go its way somewhat? We don't have to go all the way, just pull a little bit. You understand my point? Here's our example. I'm not going to make a move. I'm not going to do it because if I do, it's going to be for mischief. It's going to be to move me away from my position with God and my loyalty to him. I'm just going to read a couple things, okay? Don't turn here because I've got to shorten up the time here. But also, I want you to understand that, you know, recently a study was done on how fast things are moving. And 9% of evangelistic students that are studying theology in the world's system, 9% do not, 9% believe there is a absolute truth. The rest don't. There is no absolute truth. Do you understand how it's all moving in that direction? There is an absolute truth, and there is an absolute calling, and there is an absolute reward for our righteousness and following it, no matter how life turns out for us. Why care about this life when there's an eternity that goes before us? So you and I say, we want to be like Christ. We want to live like him. Here's what he says, "For I am the Lord, I change not. Therefore, you sons of Jacob are not consumed." Hebrews 13:8. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. He's always the same. Jeremiah 32:27. "Behold, I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. Is there anything too hard for me? This is the one we serve." Numbers 23:19, "God is not a man that he should lie, or the son of man that he should repent. Has he said and not do it? Or has he spoken and shall he not make it good?" That's what we're supposed to be following. If we say we're going to do something, we do it. We don't shrug. We don't negotiate. We don't say, "Well, things are different now." We do what we say we're going to do. This is how he is. Every good gift, every perfect gift comes from above, down from the Father of lights, in whom there is not a tiny bit of variation, not any variableness, not a shadow of turning. So my point is, I want to make sure that we understand the message today is that we don't do anything that is other than the stand that we've taken for God. The world is so used to negotiating everything, and we can find ourselves in a tendency to negotiate and to think it's okay to cut corners. And people in the Church of God worldwide are doing that today. And this is an important point for you and I to consider in our lives. Is there anything on which we won't compromise? And I'm asking us today to make a commitment to God that we will not compromise or try to negotiate with him on any area of life. We will not let the pressures of society move us.